Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development, our 8:15 start time. We are excited to have two experts, national experts, joining us via Skype on the topic of debt-free education, particularly around community college. We're going to start with Mike Krause, who's the executive director of the Drive to 55 Alliance in Tennessee. He's going to join us by Skype, and we're starting a little bit before some of our committee are here because we're on that tight time frame. These two national experts who are going to join us. So, Zach, you've got it started for us, I think. There he is. Mr. Krause, thank you for joining us. We have some of our committee here, and I expect there will be others joining us. But we're eager to hear from you and grateful for your willingness to present.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to make sure that the volume's good and everyone can hear me in the committee room.
I think we can.
A little higher.
A little higher would be great. If that maybe it looks like that may be on your end. If there's a way to go up a little bit more, that'd be great. If not, we'll make do.
Frantically looking for a volume control.
Don't worry about it. Just go ahead, and we'll listen carefully. It'll prevent any other distractions because we'll be focused on you.
Sure. No, I understand. Well, first, I appreciate the opportunity to share what we're learning in Tennessee on an ongoing basis about student financial aid. This is an exciting time in our state, and I want to make sure before we move forward, does everyone have a copy of the handout that I distributed to the committee staff yesterday?
We have it online, and I think some already have it, and I'm frantically trying to navigate to the right place, so please go ahead.
I understand. So we're going to talk just briefly about the Tennessee Promise and really why we have moved forward with this initiative in our state. I'll tell you, Tennessee Promise is about a year old. And during that time, it really has already changed the fabric of really what our students expect for their future. And for those that do have the handouts, I really want to let you see the first page. And when people ask us, why are we doing the Tennessee Promise, this data that you see before you is really the reason. We asked our data folks to answer a simple question. What is happening to students that aren't going to college in Tennessee? Because the reality is we often would hear from stakeholder groups who would say, well, not everybody needs to go to college. And so we wanted to answer what happens when they don't go to college. And so the data you'll see displayed before you in the handouts makes clear why we believe, and Governor Haslam believes, every student does need to go to college. So out of the cohort of Tennessee high school graduates from 2010, those that did not attend college, they entered the workforce directly, are making an average of $9,000 right now, and they have a 16% chance of making above minimum wage. And we found that data appalling, as I hope you do as well. $9,000 does not support a family in Tennessee or really probably in any state in America. And we really saw this data as a call to action that what we had been doing with financial aid was not working. Previously, we were heavily invested in the merit aid sector. Our students in Tennessee had the opportunity to receive a fairly generous financial aid package based on their ACT score and their high school GPA. But the fact is that was keeping a lot of students out of higher education in our state. And more importantly, we know that there were a group of Tennessee students taking themselves off the table of higher education. So they were looking around a kitchen table and saying, you know, we don't make very much money, so I can't go to college. When many of us know the reality is because your family doesn't make very much money, you can go to college. And that's what we were seeking to change when the governor launched the Tennessee Promise program. I want to walk you through, and if you go to your next slide on that presentation, I want to walk you through what do we mean when we say Tennessee Promise? What does that program encapsulate? And what are the approaches we're taking with students? First and foremost, Tennessee Promise allows us to make the following statement. Every high school graduate in Tennessee goes to community or technical college tuition free. And the way we get there is really through three prongs. I'm going to start with the first prong, because if there's any one misconception about our program, it's that it's just a financial aid program. The reality is Tennessee Promise has two other really crucial components. And the main mission of this program is to draw students to higher education that were not enrolling before. So in any given year in Tennessee, that's about 43% of our high school class not going to college. We don't know what they're doing, but we know they're not making very much money, and we know we need to alter that trajectory. So we focus on three components. First, mentorship. merely giving these students financial aid really doesn't solve the problem. These are first-generation college students. I suspect colleges in Oregon are just as difficult to navigate as colleges in Tennessee. Higher education is a system that was designed for the fluent by the fluent, and that lack of fluency often leads to students falling out of college or maybe not enrolling at all. Every single Tennessee Promise student is paired with a mentor that we have actually selected from the communities. We did a volunteer recruiting drive for mentors, and we had over 9,000 Tennesseans respond. I am a mentor in addition to my duties as executive director of the program. And that mentorship is really the pivotal aspect. So one important thing to note, when we launched Tennessee Promise statewide, it really had already been in existence in Knoxville, Tennessee for about 7 years. So we had that Knoxville experience to help us understand how this program would work. And so a key to the Knoxville experience, and now a key to our program, is the concept of focused mentorship around higher education. These mentors that I just described to you, they're not eating ice cream with the students once a week. This is not Big Brothers, Big Sisters. This is texting reminders about what higher education hurdles are ahead for the student. And in the Knoxville experience, even just that focused contact via text increased student success by 50%. The meat of Tennessee Promise, though, certainly is the financial aid component. And I'm going to describe it in detail on the next slide, but I'll just say what was important to us is that we would begin to create a sense of inevitability for these students, that at an early age, all Tennessee high school and middle school and elementary school students would begin to see themselves in college. That was what was important for us when we launched Tennessee Promise. And again, I'm going to talk about the money here in a moment. I want to get to one last part, and that is the conditions within which our students will enter college as a Tennessee Promise student. We had to face some pretty brutal facts in Tennessee that I suspect, and in fact, I looked a little bit this morning, and they are true in your colleges as well. And that is that students that attend community college part-time right after high school do not succeed. Their success rate's about 20 to 30%, and we don't like those odds. We want our students to succeed, and one of the things we found is that if you isolated just community college students that go full-time, success rates increase 40 to 50%. We're going to ask all of our Tennessee Promise students to attend full-time. We also learned that the day a student decides to take a break after high school, before they attend higher education, their chances of succeeding go down 50%. Our Tennessee Promise students will enter higher education directly after high school, and that's how they retain their eligibility. So on the next slide, we're going to get, really the next couple slides, we're going to get into two of the really detailed components around how are we paying for Tennessee Promise and what does paying for Tennessee Promise entail. First, our financial aid approach. The most important thing, if you took anything away from today's committee hearing, one, please take away that there's mentorship involved. But two, Tennessee Promise is a last dollar scholarship. And I'll just tell you, higher education is my background before I came to the governor's office. The way to pay for these programs are last dollar scholarships. For too long, I think we tried to finance student attendance in isolation of all of the various aid sources that are out there now. And so for that reason, and you'll see on the slide just a scenario, we ask students to bring to the table two types of aid, Pell Grant and state aid. And we have some pools of state financial aid that are fairly limited. We ask those students to bring that to the table, and then the gap that remains, we finance through Tennessee Promise. So what's important to focus on here is the message. The message doesn't change. The message is you're going to college for free. But we get there by leveraging some of the students' other eligible financial aid components. And by doing that, we make this feasible for our state on a fiscal perspective. The next slide you see just kind of the two pools as we think about the equation here for Tennessee Promise. Getting to a cost calculation in any state, and just so you all know, we have now provided detailed technical assistance to about 8 states. I'll now add Oregon to that list. When we talk to other states, what we tell them is, this is not a hard set of calculations. It's very likely somebody in your financial aid infrastructure already knows this information. But the starting point is, for an Oregon student going to a community or junior or technical college, how much financial aid are they getting right now? And again, somebody has that data probably on hand. And then it's a really simple delta between how much aid are they getting and how much are things costing. And on average, you come out with a round number. In our case, it was $1,156 that the average Tennessee Promise student would receive. A really important note here is that the most needy student, the Pell student who's receiving, and you all probably know, full Pell grant, is about $5,700. A student receiving full Pell grant won't get any actual money from Tennessee Promise because full Pell grant more than covers community college. But what's very important are the number of Pell recipients who weren't applying for aid. They weren't completing the FAFSA form. And so as a result, while they don't get any money from Tennessee Promise, we argue they probably wouldn't have known to apply in the first place without a governor and a legislature standing and saying college is free in Tennessee. And then on our revenue side, so we have a unique way of paying for this that I think few other states have, and that is that our lottery has been extraordinarily successful. And as a result, we have generated about a $361 million reserve, which we have placed in an aggressive investment fund, the interest of which funds this program. The point I want to make here, and again, we make this with the other states, you don't have to have a lottery endowment to do this. Our first year cost is $14 million. Our second year cost is probably going to be somewhere in the range of $25 million. And I can only speak for Tennessee to say we knew we had a lot of things we were spending $14 million on that were less worthy than being able to send students to college. We have a $32 billion state budget in Tennessee. To carve out $14 million seemed like the right thing to do. Again, we were able to do that via lottery funds. But even if we had to go into general funds, which we didn't, $14 million feels like a worthy investment to be able to look your high school students in the eye and say, everybody's going to college. The next slide, you'll see really just a timeline of how things have unfolded. We ask students to apply for the Tennessee Promise. It's not automatic. And one of our messages to students is, while this results in tuition-free college, it's not free. You have to do things. And at each of these points, whether it was an application, the mandatory meetings, we require community service for all Tennessee Promise students. At each of these waypoints, we have lost students. We have had students that haven't fulfilled the requirements. And we're very comfortable with that. Students that want to remain eligible for Tennessee Promise, which right now between 55 and 60% of our original applicants are eligible. Students that want to remain eligible complete the requirements. I want to talk a little bit now just about what's unfolded as far as numbers at each of these points.
And Mr. Krause, I got to interrupt for just a second. Unfortunately, yeah, we're getting very close on our time. We have the great honor of having you and Professor Goldrick Grab from Wisconsin, who has a similar like 15-minute window. So I hate to do it, but if you could wrap up, we want to get to her too.
Absolutely. 85% of our seniors applied. Tennessee now leads the nation in FAFSA completion by double digits. And of all of the nation's FAFSA completion growth, our state alone accounts for 40% of it. Wow. So if I've got to wrap up, that's what we like to say. We've already seen progress. If you look at your next slide, you just see a group of teenagers. Those are hundreds of teenagers lined up around a building to sign up for Tennessee Promise. This program has already changed the conversation about going to college in our state, and we're certainly available for any technical assistance you might need moving forward. Good luck.
We appreciate it very much. Are there any quick questions for Mr. Krause? And we'll get on to Professor Goldrick Grab.
Is there a website?
Representative Wisnett asks if there is a website we should be looking at.
Tennessee Promise.
Yes, sir, Representative. Please go to the tnpromise.gov.
Yeah.
You'll see all of our program requirements laid out there. And then if you look at any of the recent news articles available via Google, again, that FAFSA increase cannot be understated. To be the number one state in the nation for FAFSA and for one state to account for 40% of the nation's FAFSA growth, to me, demonstrates what happens when you put a framework around going to college for students.
It's very impressive. We really appreciate the example and your willingness to testify, and I hope that we're going to be calling on you regularly for more technical assistance. Thank you so much.
I look forward to traveling to Oregon. See you soon.
We'll be glad to have you. Thanks a lot. Zach, if you can help us get connected with Professor Goldrick Grab, that would be great.
All-star guest, man.
Yeah.
Here she
Professor Golder Krebs, this is Tobias Reed here. Thank you for your patience. We were just hearing from Mike Krause from the Tennessee Promise. I know you've got another big and significant gathering you're managing today in Wisconsin. So thank you for making some time for us. The committee's assembled. Senator Haas is in the audience, and we're eager to hear from you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your having me here today. The opportunity to testify is greatly appreciated. I'm going to be talking a little bit about what I've learned over the last 15 years, studying ways to make college more affordable and working both with the federal government as well as state legislatures and community groups. I fully support this bill, and I want to tell you about why. This is a bold effort that, quite frankly, probably wasn't necessary perhaps 20 years ago, but today it's sorely needed. And that's because, according to a report by the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, by 2018, 64% of all jobs in Wisconsin will require some form of post-secondary training beyond high school. Now, there's a popular perception that people today can already go get that training for free at community colleges, where some people believe the education is all free or nearly free, especially for students from low to moderate income households. And some people believe that the real challenges facing students have more to do with academic underpreparation or informational barriers. If only this were true. In fact, the average out-of-pocket cost facing Oregon community college students from low-income families today ranges from $8,000 to $11,000 per year. Now, that's after all grant aid has been taken into account, and it represents the amount that students must borrow and often also earn through work in order to make college possible. The situation facing moderate income families is actually not much better, and they're in a more difficult position because they also have little disposable income, and yet they cannot access the federal Pell Grant. Now, 30 years ago, high schools in Oregon were focused on helping more students envision college as part of their future. And 20 years ago, they began really focusing on academic preparation for college. But the result is that today you have ambitious, academically prepared high school graduates who are attending college but leaving without a degree or credential of any kind in hand because they can't afford to stay long enough to finish their degree. That among the academically prepared high school graduates, more than one in five from low-income families forgoes college entirely, and about 10% of those who started a two-year college not any credential. Completion rates signal talent loss, and that things are only getting worse. Rates of enrollment in college. It will boost their persistence rates, and it may also increase their graduation rates. Now, rigorous studies have looked at these things, and they have found that reducing the cost of community college by even $1,000 a year can result in substantial increases across the board. Low-income students enroll directly from high school. More low-income students enroll who otherwise would never have enrolled at all. More of them transfer to four-year colleges and universities. And the students who would not have enrolled the fact that community college became affordable are more than 20% more likely to earn a bachelor's degree within 8 years of high school graduation. All that for a $1,000 discount is a pretty good deal. Financial challenges right now. In fact, today's financial aid system overlooks a lot of real financial need held by families everywhere, including in Oregon. It's hardly adequate. And there are benefits of a universal approach like the one you're describing that extend beyond impacts on today's students. It also sends powerful signals to the potential students of tomorrow who believe will respond by working even harder in K-12 education to get to these opportunities that you're setting up for them. Now, can the proposed policy be strengthened to be more effective? It would be better if it was able to mirror President Obama's approach in serving as a first dollar rather than last dollar scholarship, but this is nearly impossible for your state to do without federal help. It would also, of course, be preferable to include public colleges and universities in the plan so that financially constrained students would have more choices, but of course, this costs additional money. And ideally, you would be able to complement this effort with financial support for greater academic and social needs for community college students as well. But you have to start somewhere, and I applaud you for taking this step. Supporting more hardworking people throughout Oregon as they seek your very fine community colleges, and helping more of those who've started on their pathway complete their certificates and degrees, I believe that's a very sound investment in your state's future. And so I support the bill.
Thank you very much. If you've got time for a couple of questions, one I'd like to ask is just help us understand, amidst all the scholarship you've done as a national expert on these issues, how does this rank or why does this rise to the top of the various strategies that various states pursue?
I think that many of these strategies that states have pursued are what I would describe as small bureaucratic changes to a system that has many, many problems. And so what they've been are small tweaks to try to make things a little bit easier for families. And unfortunately, making small tweaks to a very large, very broken system does not seem to work very well. What you're doing is fundamentally transformative. It recognizes that we've had the same system, the same basic financial aid approach for 50 years, and it's done some good, but it's not working in the 21st century. And it asks people of Oregon to think a little more boldly about their future and to make sure, to make certain that when people get ready in high school, they don't then encounter a college they simply can't afford and have their dreams dashed. It asks them to do something bigger, and I think it will move you into the next phase of the 21st century in a much more productive way than those that don't take these steps.
Very good. Any questions for Professor Goldrick-Grab? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Professor, for being with us today. Appreciate your presentation. What value or what sort of academic standards or expectations would you see placing on entry into such an offering? Do you think there's a value in having a minimum grade point average coming out of K-12 or other sort of relationships and or attachments with mentors as Tennessee requires? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, these are very important questions. And the first thing I just want you to know is that these are going to be very difficult decisions. One of the reasons is that it tends to be the case that students with higher GPAs in high school already get more financial assistance. But the other really important part is they've already demonstrated an ability to manage their time and go through schooling while getting high grades. These are the students who, frankly, are going to be better able to work while they're in school and still get it done. The students that we really have to worry about and the students who need this policy the most are the ones who will only make it through college if they can focus entirely on school. Working while in college will distract them from their studies. But if they're supported in this way, they will finish their degrees. And so I would encourage you to not place a GPA requirement for high school that excludes the academic middle. And so what I mean there is, please do not place it any higher than a C average. I know that stands in contrast to many other programs in the country, but it will ensure that the money is actually given in the most cost-effective manner. It is not a reward for having already done well. It is an investment to ensure that college actually pays off for them. The same thing goes, by the way, for during college. Georgia has learned from a very large mistake that it has made in attaching the continuation of grant funding to a specific GPA. Students cannot continue to get the Georgia Hope Scholarship unless they get a B average. Georgia is driving down the production of STEM degrees with this move. And that is because students know how to get good grades. They do it by taking fewer courses and easier courses. And this has extended their time to degree and had very unintended consequences. So I'm very wary of GPA requirements that sound good on paper, but actually cut the legs off of the effectiveness of a policy. Now, mentoring is a good thing. But if you condition on people who've already had access to mentors, again, you're reaching for people who probably could do this even without your policy. What you want to do is reach for the sweet spot of people who, if you give them this additional support, you will add value value to their chances of completing degrees. So I do think that mentoring is important, and it should ideally be a component of the program. But you need to first give them the support so that they have the time to access the mentors. Many low-income students do not meet with mentors for lack of time because of the commitments required to be with their families. And so it's really important to recognize that.
Time for
Representative Gagos, please.
Professor, I have a question around some of the other elements that would need to go into such a program. I mean, faculty for one thing. I mean, choosing it and hiring the right kind of faculty. The second thing being then the curriculum offerings, making sure that you can cover the kinds of courses needed. How do those things fit into sort of an equation like this?
Yeah, those are terrific questions, and to be honest, you're setting yourself apart from predecessors who in the early 1970s dramatically expanded access to college without dealing with the capacity of the colleges, and that's what you're referring to. It is very important. It is important that if you pass this, you do also have to think ahead with the colleges about how they will meet growing demand. Now, the good news is that community colleges around the country have shown themselves to be very nimble at meeting growing demand when they have resources to do so. And so I can tell you that, for example, just take California. When their community colleges have not had the courses required, as soon as a bond referenda is passed that provides more resources to the college, those courses are immediately opened up. They usually have a long waiting list of qualified faculty to teach these things, but they don't have the resources to fund them. So there will have to be some investment made in ensuring that they can meet the demand. But a community college education is a very cost-effective investment. What you're going to spend as the legislature versus what you're going to get for a return on your investment is quite substantial. These people who get these degrees are going to go through much fewer spells of unemployment in their lives, if any. They're going to earn higher wages, and they're going to contribute to your tax base in the long run. So you will be, in fact, reaping these rewards for a long time.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor, for your presentation. I'm old enough to have lived in California during free community college. Have you studied what went wrong there? And also, all this, we still have to bring costs down, and I think we have to change the delivery model of education, and that affects the capacity. If you're using more online, more Skype, things like this, could you comment on that, please?
Sure. These are very good questions, and I'm glad that you did bring up California. To be honest with you, I don't think in many ways that California is a great example of free community college, and that's for several reasons. One of them is the way that the funding model was configured. They essentially ended up leaving a lot of money on the table. Okay? They didn't actually access federal resources that would have been available to them had they configured their system differently. And I know that your folks are thinking through that issue. Another issue is the way that it was framed to students was as if the only cost of college going was tuition and fees. Now, I know you all know better than that. Students have to also cover their living expenses. And so it's going to be very important to frame for them the available opportunities in terms of federal work study and other employment opportunities so that they can afford to cover their expenses. But if this model was produced properly, what would happen is for low and moderate income students, they would be able to access the Pell Grant and the SEOG and other federal aid on top of getting the tuition free, and that will help to cover their expenses. That should make a difference that, in fact, we did not actually see in California for a variety of reasons about program design. In terms of your attention to lowering costs, I'm going to fully agree with you that we do have to lower the actual cost, not just the price, which is what we're really talking about here today. I think that the issue here is the need to be strategic about whom you bring those new delivery models to. So the most vulnerable people who are currently the most risky in higher education are the ones who need the high impact practices, face-to-face instruction. They need to be in the classroom so that they can connect to another individual who will support them as they go through college. So I would suggest that the delivery models that you want to see changed are best brought not to first and second year students, but rather to more advanced students. Bring those delivery models to the people who've already gotten a degree and are coming back for a second degree, for example. Bring those delivery models to the students in their third and fourth years of education at your universities. But be very cautious about about muting the extent to which there's interpersonal interaction that is so important for the most vulnerable people who are pursuing higher education for the very first time. That is not necessarily the best experience to give them right off the bat.
Very much. Thank you. We can probably fill up as much time as you have with questions, but I know you've got some other big responsibilities today. So we're really grateful for your time and hope that we're going to have opportunities for you to come out in person to pick up on your point just a moment ago. I feel like in some ways in higher education, Oregon is that that first-year student that that needs the high-impact intervention. So hopefully we'll have a chance for you to come out.
Grateful to you all for having this conversation. I'm so pleased that you are, and I thank your national leaders for doing so.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Zach. And we'll continue now with some in-person conversation. Senator Hast, do you want to come up and bring your guests, President Galizio and Chief O'Day? We jumped right in before you came without necessarily the context or the benefit of explaining the conversation you've been having in the Senate or very much about the bill that's now in Ways and Means. So I think the committee may benefit from that as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for this discussion. I'm very impressed. You had some national heavyweights on this. I've got some heavyweights here, too. In fact, we could go outside and Skype in if that's...
we're in that mode now, aren't we?
Yes. Well, I have a former colleague, most of you know, former representative, now president of Clatsop Community College, Larry Galizio, who's a strong advocate, and he's on the ground, and he sees the need here. And about 6 months ago, Tom Hanks wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about how community college made his career. And I talked to Chief O'Day, and I said, "You're our Tom Hanks," and you'll see why here in a minute. And so I'll give it to them. But yes, just to update you, we're talking about Senate Bill 81. It passed the Senate Education Committee a month ago, and it's now down into Ways and Means. And we started working on this the same time as Tennessee did, and. Oregon likes to study things for a long time. Tennessee just pulled the trigger. And so while I would have liked to have been first, they were first, but there's a lot of value in being second. And that is, as you heard, it works really, really well. And we're using the same model as they are, last dollar in. And that's critically important because what has happened in Tennessee is all of these people are applying for federal Pell Grants, and they're getting them. People that didn't apply 2 years ago. And so Tennessee became by far the largest FAFSA applicant in the country, and all of this federal money is raining in on Tennessee. And there are kids there learning how to be welders using federal money to do that. And I'm certain that could happen here because we have that same population of young people. The Oregon Youth Commission says about 70,000 kids between 18 and 24 with really nothing going on. They have no post-secondary education, they have no job, and they have no money. All they need is an opportunity. These are not bad people, they're not criminals. And but they are expensive. They cost around $14,000 a year in social services and direct costs to society. The minute that one of them gets a job as a welder at Gunderson Marine is the minute that $14,000 a year stops. So that's what we're trying to do. The financial model with leveraging all this money makes a lot of sense, but giving Oregon sons and daughters the opportunity makes a lot of sense to me, too. So let me turn it over to my experts here. Chief?
Chief, happy to hear from you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Larry O'Day. I'm here on my own, not representing the city, but I'm also the Chief of Police for the City of Portland. Thank you all for allowing me a few minutes to speak today. I know you're all very busy, but I want to share with you my experience around community college, both personally and professionally. Personally, I believe very strongly in the opportunity that community college gave me. I believe that it directly is related to why I've been successful and why I was ultimately able to become the chief of police. I was just a regular person, you know, like so many folks. I had no special skills or abilities. You know, my employment options were limited as such. I graduated from high school, and I did know that I wanted to be a police officer. I attended Portland Community College and obtained an Associate of Science degree in Criminal Justice. The majority of my classes were taught by working professionals in the field. They provided real-world education and training that resonated with me and my fellow students, that interaction that the doctor talked about, having that interaction directly with those instructors, with those teachers, made a difference for me, made that connection for me. I will go on later to work professionally with many of my instructors. That degree made me instantly marketable to many more agencies and gave me much more opportunity. I was quickly hired by the Portland Police Bureau after I graduated and went to the Basic Police Academy. My degree had given me a head start, and that was a theme that would continue throughout my career. Since I had a criminal justice degree, I sailed through the Police Academy as I was already educated in so much of my new field. I was able to really focus my efforts on the few things that I'd had less exposure to. Community college gave me many things. You know, it gave me specific job skills. It gave me opportunity. It gave me relationships with professionals working in the field. It gave me marketability, and it gave me a jump start. It gave me access to a career and to an economic class that would have been otherwise unavailable to me. It's allowed me to live in a nice house and to put my wife and son through college. And both of them started with community college and are successful professionals today. Professionally, I see when people have economic opportunity, like that which community college provides, they're much less likely to be involved negatively with the criminal justice system. Many of the offenders that we encounter lack secondary education. In my 30 years in this profession, the vast majority of offenders that I have encountered have not had a college education. A bachelor's degree may not be for everybody, but community college is. It changes lives. It gives people specialized skill and education, creates tremendous opportunity. It allows regular people like me to become successful, and it helps to create a safer, healthier, and more prosperous community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. President, and maybe we can have some discussion with everybody after we hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Wisnant, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I couldn't think of something clever after Senator Hass said Chief O'Day is the Tom Hanks of Oregon. I couldn't think of anyone that parallels with Tom Hanks, so at some point I'll figure that out. Thank you for the opportunity. I want to thank Senator Hass because, and I'm very impressed with the committee getting the national experts in this conversation and discussion and figuring out how we can provide access to opportunity and also successful completion so you get that cost-effective return on investment so that Oregonians can compete successfully in the global, very competitive 21st century economy. So, but I think a couple of key points that were made and why I think Senator Hass's bill is really important is, number one, the symbolic element to it, the message of that we see is clearly working in Tennessee, that, hey, you can afford to attend post-secondary education, whether that's a certificate or an associate's degree. The symbolic element should not be ignored, and I think that's very important. Secondly, that federal money through the FAFSA, and by the way, obviously, the federal government is trying to do a better job of streamlining and simplifying the FAFSA. And as the parent of three children, I hope by the time the FAFSA, that it'll be less than 156 questions or whatever it is. So that's important. But that's also so important. So another important element to this effort. And then, you know, it's hard when you follow the national experts, but just a couple things. Representative Wisnant talked about being in California when it was essentially free, I too, of course, I'm a lot younger than you, but I too was in California when community college was essentially free, and I did so poorly in high school. And fortunately, I had a mentor who said, hey, go to the community college, and it was transformative. That was the catalyst for my belief that I could succeed. And it was really, it was essentially free in terms of tuition and fees. We do know that probably 21% of the cost for students is tuition and fees. Transportation, living is obviously the most expensive element to the education, unless they live at home. And then transportation and books are also very expensive. But that was the catalyst that allowed me to then move on to affordable higher education. And so that was so critical. And there are problems now with the state and the way they fund it. But it was that opportunity that was critical. That's why I do what I do. And in addition, we have so many more students, and I know this, you know, we're early, somewhat early in the conversation, but a lot of our students at Clatsop Community College, and I know we're not unique in Oregon community colleges, are returning students. So this is important because it sends a message to middle school and high school families and students, and I hope down the road we look at how we're going to support the returning students. But I know the details are going to be the most critical part, and that's the work that all of you must do. But I have to say that just at the level of providing the boost for the opportunity and the belief that you can succeed is really important. A high school diploma is no longer sufficient for the jobs that are required in the 21st century. So to the extent this bill and this effort makes 2 years of college essentially universal, because that's where the economy is, right? 65% of the jobs in the future are going to require some kind of post-secondary education certificate or degree. So the economy is going, and so we have to decide whether or not we want Oregonians to be ready to compete. I mean, high school diploma is no longer sufficient. So I know that the time is short. I just want to support the effort, and I think it's critical, and Oregon is in a good spot to do this. And I think the return on investment, as Professor Goldrick Rabb talked about, is there. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Gagos.
Thank you very much. I just want to comment and end with a question, but certainly community college was a factor in my getting a start in education. And Senator mentioned Gunderson Brothers. Actually, I worked for Gunderson for 10 years while I was going to community college. And I suppose that I am one of those demographics that we're talking about in terms of first generation, low income, and so on. I also taught in the California state system as well for about 10 years while they had the free community college business. And I guess my concern is, or the question that I want to look at is, we had a presentation by the HEC the other day where they were talking about enrollment not necessarily being sort of the metric we want to look at, but also outcome as well. And I guess the questions I want to have, or I do have to do with, again, the kind of question I asked earlier. What about, what is this going to mean in terms of faculty, in terms of the curriculum offerings? How do we ensure that we are offering the kinds of courses and have the kind of faculty, the kind of support systems? We talk about mentoring. Clearly, advising and mentoring are important elements of this. So I guess at some point I'd be interested in seeing the larger picture beyond just, you know, the tuition and FAFSA support. What is this going to mean in terms of the industry, I guess?
If I may, please, Chair Reed and also Vice Chair Gallegos, I'm sorry, I missed that. So as a 16-year faculty member of Portland Community College, very concerned with quality, I appreciate your question, and I'll let the senator talk about the components of the bill. But as you probably know, in the last 5, maybe 10 years, the focus has really shifted in community colleges nationally from not just access, but to completion. And there's some exciting research about that. And so statewide, under the work of the HEC, we are looking at a developmental or remedial education redesign. The research coming out of Columbia University and other places, Texas, is very clear that we are doing a poor job with students who take a test and then place in developmental ed courses. So with that research and with some of the progress that you've seen in other states, I think you'll begin to see that in Oregon as we shift and restructure developmental education. So those students who don't do well in high school and have challenges, I think they will be arrive. In fact, I know they will be arriving at Oregon's 17 community colleges working in a different structure, a whole, you know, with different supports, advising, and quality, and the faculty are right, they're leading this effort, quite frankly. And so that's very exciting. So to your point, of course it requires resources, but there is a restructuring going on that I think is absolutely critical, and I appreciate your question.
Representative Gallegos. We've been working pretty closely with the Community College Association the last few months, and they came to us after the interim and said, here's everything we need. There were about a dozen components, details, and we amended all of those things in there, and I think we got them to a place where, while they may be nervous, they're okay. And they said, all we need now is the money. And that's not an inconsequential part of this conversation. We have a pretty detailed bill in Ways and Means. It does require an appropriation. It's a no-frills flying coach plan, but it's essentially going to be about a $20 million appropriation, which is a lot of money, but it feels like a pretty good price to say we have free community college in this state. You heard the figures from Mike Krause in Tennessee, $14 million a year for his state. Well, they have a considerably larger population. So that's how cheaply you could do this, because most of the bills will be paid by the federal government. And it just is amazing to me how much more federal money is coming to Tennessee because of that. And I just think it's an opportunity there. But we've got a pretty detailed plan in there, and I urge you to walk through it. It's the last dollar in. We do have a $50 copay for students, because there was a conversation we had in the Senate about personal responsibility and just to make sure people aren't going to mess around with the system, and that anybody can find $50. And if they can't, they could come over to my house on Saturday afternoon, and I could show them how to make it. And I think the community colleges are okay. I think, you know, the capacity issues are okay. We've been told the enrollment was really high in the last few years. Now it's down. So I think we're okay. All the rules are in place where nobody's going to be signing up to take fly fishing courses, and all of that kind of details is taken together. We're talking about certificate programs, core classes for people who want to get Head Start on their four-year degree. So I think we're covered, and I think we're modeled. It's the same model as Tennessee is using.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Galizio, one of the things from Tennessee was I thought was amazing is he had 9,000 mentors. How do we have a plan? Does the Senate Bill 81 have a plan for recruiting and training mentors and helping them? The other question is, I've been telling everyone that you need to watch the movie McFarland USA. And the lesson, I think one of the lessons that comes out of that movie is that education has to change. I brought that up with the doctor from Wisconsin. Your mode of delivery to fit the people that need to go to the education. If they're picking in the fields in California at 5 in the morning, they can't come out and train to run track. They need to change the hours of delivering, whether that's through online or other kinds of courses. But we can't have it if that culture and that group of people, you know, are not available to go to college when we're presenting it. That's going to leave a lot of people out. So if you could comment on those, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnant, great questions. In terms of the bill specifically and mentors, I'll let the senator respond to that. But that sounds very exciting, and the way that works. Can't claim to be an expert on how it's, you know, the particulars of the Tennessee model, but you know, all of us who've been fortunate enough to have a mentor or somebody who helped guide us in some very important period of our lives know how critical that is. And so to that end, the research that we're seeing, and there's a lot more focus on community college, and there's a lot better research taking place as we, you know, understand the brain better and we understand what's required for completion and success. It's not enough to just get someone in the door. How do you get them so they succeed and earn a certificate and degree? And there's a lot of great work going on. And so your questions are right on about how do we do that, right? So we get that return on investment. So I'd say number one is the research is pretty clear that you need what we call, or some of us call, intrusive advising. early alerts. If a student starts to falter, they get a call. And that takes resources. So at ClatSap, we don't have the resources to do that with the number of students we should. But these guided pathways, the aggressive, intrusive advising and work with students who just don't have the foundation. That's really important. Secondly, I've not seen the film, but you're right. We in higher education need to do a better job. I think, number one, the research is telling us a lot of what some of those means to have greater success are, and they include more intensive advising and other types of supports and doing a better job, especially initially, because the vulnerable period is in the first two terms. And I do think it's very important what Professor Goldrick Raab pointed out. Distance learning or online delivery can be effective. However, the research is pretty clear that for the most vulnerable students, the most academically challenged students, a lot of the students that we get coming through our doors, that's not the best way to provide an education. At the same time, I think her point was well taken, when you look at the later years, the junior and senior years, it might be possible. But you're right, and fortunately the research is going that way in terms of how to better get the completion. And so the developmental ed redesign is really something here that's already happening. So.
Thank you.
And Representative Wisdom, there is a mentoring requirement in Senate Bill 81, advisory and mentoring. It's a critical part of the puzzle.
The committee's heard me say before that I really enjoy asking people what they think is the largest institution of higher education in Oregon, and the surprise when people learn that it's PCC. So, President Galizio, you were at PCC. Chief O'Day, you see PCC probably more than the rest of us. What's been your assessment of how things, how the city and PPB interact with PCC?
Very well. In fact, one of the things that I'm working on now, just because I've had such a great experience with community college, is developing a formal relationship between the Portland Police Bureau and our department, looking for that kind of that pipeline, getting people into community college, going from community college into employment with my police bureau. The Portland Community College has invested a tremendous amount in both their North Portland facility and their Southeast Portland facility, and we have contact with them on a regular basis for a variety of reasons. But I've seen such a tremendous expansion there that that we have relationships with them and interaction with them very regularly.
Great. Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So. Let's see, you say that there's a Senator Haas, you say that there's a mentoring requirement in there, and I don't see it in the A version of the bill, except for it says academic advising requirements. The heck shall govern academic advising requirements. Is that what you're talking about for mentoring?
Yes, advising.
Okay. And then also you said that there's sideboards in here that keep it from someone from just majoring in fly fishing or something like that. Where is that in the bill? I don't really see that.
What section? We'll get you that section.
Get back to me on that. Yes. Can I ask one
yes,
more?
Yes, please.
So there was kind of a little bit of a difference of opinion between the Mr. Kraus and Professor Goldrick Ray on the concept, it's kind of the skin in the game concept. So it seems like the Tennessee attitude is, obviously you have to fill out the FAFSA, which that's, I've done those before too, so that's a significant hoop, whatever, so I'll grant that. And then I know your bill also has a $50 requirement, and that sounds modest, but for someone who's, doesn't have any money, that's a little bit of a hoop. Mm-hmm. But the Tennessee requirement talked about that you have to do community service. And that was contrasted from Dr. Goldrick Raab talking about for that middle level people, they can't make it if you have them work. The upper kids can work because they can manage that, but it's that middle level that can't. What's as far as like working or the community service or whatever. What's your vision of where this goes?
Thank you. I think there's two different tiers there. The most community colleges, I don't know about classes, but have some sort of work study where whatever the situation, you go and you can work in the cafeteria and get paid. And when we looked at this during the interim, we kind of pulled back on, we don't want that to be another barrier. Some people just need an 8-month coursework to get a certificate to be a medical assistant, and we didn't think they should go down to the park and have to plant flowers to do that. Maybe it might be different for a 4-year degree. And so when the issue of personal responsibility came up, the copay seemed like the most efficient, and by doing that you avoid a lot of extra bureaucracy that is expensive in administering a work program in order to receive free tuition. That was kind of the thinking.
Okay, good. And you have.
Why don't you give us
Section 2B.
Section 2B. Thank you.
Thanks. Let's go to Representative Hayden, then we'll come back to Representative Johnson Gagos.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I have a question on looking at the information on the Tennessee model and comparing that to Oregon. U.S. average graduation rates from high school is about 81.5%. Tennessee is 86.3%. And then we have Oregon at 68.7%. It seems like Tennessee has maybe a more stable platform to start with, if you will, as far as high school graduation rates. So how does this bill help us get to where our students are ready to go to community college?
Thank you. That's a great question. It kind of opens a door on some issues. Representative Hayden, I haven't talked to anybody who doesn't think this is a worthwhile idea, but I have had people nervous about it, and they say things like, well, you know, we have a low graduation rate. Shouldn't we work on that before we do this? We have high absenteeism in Oregon. Shouldn't we deal with that first? We have a remedial program where a lot of our high school graduates have to take remedial classes before college. Shouldn't we do that? And I would implore you to not let those issues get in the way of this thing that we should do. This is one thing. It is not going to eradicate poverty, solve world hunger, or eliminate all of the other problems in education. It is just one thing out of a dozen or more that we should do. And yes, we need to raise our graduation rates. I think it's lower than than other states. For a couple of reasons, some of just in the bureaucracy of how we compute those rates, some having to do with fifth and sixth year programs, which unfairly makes our graduation rates look lower than they are. But it's a legitimate question, and I think it cries out to the need that we need to do more, if anything. And yes, we need to do a more focused effort on inching up those graduation rates, working on absenteeism and all of those things. But I would implore you not to use other issues in our education system as reasons why we couldn't do that, because if we use that same mindset, we won't do anything on any of those issues.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here today. Great presentation. This is a topic that got some notoriety during the interim period, and then somehow during the fog of session, it's kind of been, you've been working on it, but now it's been ensconced down in Ways and Means where it sits percolating, waiting for the next phase. But some great comments today and some great testimony. Question for you, Senator Hass. You touched on some of the issues, I think, particularly relating to fifth and sixth year high school students. And again, as we talk about the dollars and cents necessary for this going forward, there's a need, you know, $20 million need or whatever has been attached to it. But we also know that these fifth and sixth year students are also creating some, let's say, hardships within the state school fund. Mm-hmm. By virtue of districts hanging on to these kids a little bit longer than a traditional student would, most districts do, kind of keeping them in the nest perhaps a little longer than they might otherwise. But I wonder if you might just touch on that as an idea of providing some offsets, let's say, in the total budgetary scheme of things, that if we did a little bit of courageous work over here, we might free up some dollars that could pay for this program, or at least a significant portion of it.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson. yeah, for those of you who are unfamiliar with the fifth and sixth year program, it's when a high school says, look, you have enough credits to graduate from high school, but if you don't graduate now and stay another year or two, we'll pay your costs to go to college or receive college credits. 26 districts do that now. The cost to the K-12 fund is $19 million in this biennium. Don't get me wrong, all of those districts, their heart's in the right place. They are helping kids who should be helped. The problem is they're taking the money from the K-12 fund and using it for college. A bigger sin to me, though, is we have federal money that's available to help those same kids. Mm-hmm. And many of those kids would receive 100% Pell Grant. We're using all state money for that. And so it's not the most cost-effective approach. I think if we did free community college, it would make those efforts moot. They wouldn't need to do that. If I was in a small school district and this was the only tool available, I'd probably do it too. Most of these districts that do are smaller, but if Portland or Beaverton started doing this, it would swamp the boat, and all of a sudden we'd have a K through 14 system, and we'd still have large class sizes in first grade, and now we're doing college. And so I don't think that's the most effective approach. I would prefer this approach, but I don't want to get on the wrong side of those school districts who are trying to use anything they can think of to help provide opportunities for their kids.
Yeah. Representative Gallegos, do you have a follow-up on that? Then we can.
Thank you.
Sorry, Representative Gallegos, we'll come back.
Yeah, just you do have in the bill the academic advising requirements at the community college level, but I will say I'm really intrigued by Tennessee's mentoring program. Committee, I don't know how many of you have actually gone in to look at the Tennessee Promise website and so forth, but they actually require a couple of mentoring appointments prior to even beginning to fill out the FAFSA. You know, so there is a process there before you even get to that point of saying, okay, this does sound good for me. So if there could be a way, I understand that's going to take a lot more to pull this off, and somebody would have to administer that and organize it, but in terms of the success and longevity of the program, and for these students, I just think that's such a key component. But the other thing I would say regarding developmental ed and remedial is I was noticing this morning, I did a little research before we came down here, but Tennessee is even moving towards eliminating remedial courses for this, and because they're going to have additional wraparound and support services through these mentors to try to give those students the extra supports that they need, so that you will have all college, all of these will count for post-secondary accreditation. There won't be any wasted credits at all, if you will. So that, again, is a bold step, but, you know, that's a state that's been looking at this for a while. They've had some pilots, I think, within Tennessee that they've had a chance to learn from. So, and one other point about, you know, again, the whole spectrum of students, they have what they call the Tennessee Reconnect, which is all about students who have folks within the population group who are post-24, I believe, who want to come back and get that technical certificate, and it applies to those, too. So we're not just talking about straight out of high school kids. So very intriguing. Love the concept. So look forward to working with you on it.
Nice. Representative Gallegos, sorry for...
Thank you. No, that's fine. I mean, I want to thank Representative Johnson for opening up the discussion about K-12. Because I do think, again, thinking about what are the other pieces to the puzzle that need to sort of be in support of this particular bill and project. I met with the Hillsborough School District Saturday, and they've got some interesting budgeting approaches that our discussion ended up with the idea, actually, of be great to maybe have a joint session between Higher Ed Committee and the K-12 Ed Committee as well, to just really think about this whole process, because I think it is a process that we need to attend to. The other thing, comment I wanted to make had to do with when I was at the University of Portland, I really had about a $30,000 budget each year in community service work study that I was able to distribute to students. And they were able to then get in 20 hours a week in a service experience that actually they were able to put on their resume, and in some cases actually got credit for some of that work. So I really loved it. It was a great way to help students in terms of financial aid. And I don't know you know, the service thing was really big for a while. I don't know if it's still out there or not, but it seems to me another way to look at financial aid for students. And the other final comment I would make is you'd mentioned, President, the whole issue of hope for these students and getting them to believe that they can succeed. I mean, I think that is, to me, one of the more critical pieces that maybe doesn't come from curriculum, but comes really from the mentoring, the advising. I can tell you from my personal experience, I wouldn't even allow myself to believe that I could get a bachelor's degree until I got through the second year of community college. I said, well, look, I've already got 2 years. Why the hell not go for the other two? I mean, it was that basic. So I do think that again, those values, instilling that belief system is really critical.
Anything else, committee?
Representative Hayden.
One quick further comment, and yep. Thank you for the response. One of the concerns that I have, particularly in Oregon, is over the last 3 or 4 years, our graduation rates from high school for students with disabilities continues to decline. And it's already low, down to a 37%. So, well, you know, community college is important with our 40-40-20 goal. Some of these, I'm not sure how that fits into the 40-40-20 goal with the community college. And like Representative Gallego says, interacting with the high school level, particularly for children low income, 60%, disabilities, 37%, to engage them as part of the process is, I think, important.
Thank you.
Representative Wisdom.
Senator, three members of this committee are on Ways and Means.
That's why I
wonder why he's here.
You know, what do you think, or what can we do? What do you think the chances are? And with the budget getting tighter and tighter, as we all know, that serve in this building, I hate to say this, but Tennessee talked about that they did it, started in Knoxville first. Do we want to pick, you know, I'm just...
Were you going to suggest Redmond?
No, we got that fifth year going.
I think things might come into clear focus on Thursday when we get the revenue forecast. Yeah. That's one thing. A second, we do have some history with the Eastern Promise, which is a highly successful, just sort of all, you know, kind of all, no laws are written, and it sort of just worked in a very small population. We can't do it based on a handshake statewide, but it worked pretty well, and that's kind of what the inspiration for this was. And so we do have some experience in the category, and I just think that if this was just a direct contribution from the state that didn't leverage any federal money, I think it would be one thing. But what we've seen in Tennessee is it's a huge leverage of financial resources. And more than that, I agree with President Galizio. This will be good for our mojo. Now, we're a state that does free community college. Everybody feels good about that, particularly the families who are struggling right now and their kids who can say, you know, I could be a police officer. I might be able to do this.
Thank you. And please. And this free 2 years is definitely going to help our affordable degree that we have out there.
Do you have a sense? Do you have a sense of the ratio? So $20 million from the state. How much that would bring in from the feds?
It's several hundred million in Tennessee.
Okay.
So I get you know they have about million, yeah. 6.5 million population, or under four.
Okay. That's a significant mm-hmm. advantage if nothing else were to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great. Okay. Well, the three of us on Ways and Means will have even more reason to follow this, and I think the committee, I think it was important for us to have this conversation because if the concept is to move forward, we want to be able to say sincerely that the committee had a chance to talk about the policy in addition to the financial impacts. So. We appreciate you guys coming and being part of the conversation. Thank you very much.
For a very thoughtful discussion.
Thanks. So that's our agenda for today. Thank you for being here early so that we could hear from Professor Golder Grab and Mr. Krause. That was very, very helpful. Yeah. And we are, what time on Wednesday, Victoria?
8:30
on Wednesday. Yeah.
What's on the forecast?
And no meeting on Friday. Wednesday we have on the agenda.
Is that Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon?
I think we are going to talk about their yeah. process. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have a work session scheduled for the sexual assault bill that we heard earlier. So we'll see. We have a couple of amendments. We saw some people today who are reacting to those.
That's Oriel and Olas.
So
the amendments.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. So they're the ones that we talked about as well. But you can look at that. So we'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you very much. We're adjourned. We're adjourned.